Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Judy Melnick and T.J. Mitchell, who will speak about their book, Working Stiff. Judy Melnick, M.D., is a graduate of Harvard University. She trained at UCLA in medicine and pathology, graduating in 1996. Her training at the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in New York is the subject of her memoir, Working Stiff, which she co-wrote with her husband. Currently, Dr. Melnick is an associate clinical professor at UCSF and works as a forensic pathologist in Oakland. She also travels nationally and internationally to lecture on anatomic and forensic pathology, and she has been consulted as a forensic expert in many high-profile legal cases, as well as for the television shows ER and Mythbusters. T.J. Mitchell, her husband, graduated with an English degree from Harvard and has worked as a screenwriter's assistant and script editor since 1991. He is a writer and stay-at-home dad, raising their three children in San Francisco. Working Stiff is their final book, and it will be for sale outside in the lobby after the program.
Thank you. Hi, I'm TJ. I'm here to introduce Judy a little bit, and then she is going to tell you all about forensic pathology and about our book, Working Stiff. Judy grew up in New York City. As Bill just mentioned, she and I met in college. We started dating as freshmen, so we're practically high school sweethearts. Moved together out to Los Angeles in 1991 so Judy could go to medical school there. She also did her pathology residency in Los Angeles. And then after that, we moved to New York City so that Judy could do a one-year fellowship in forensic pathology, which means learning how to do autopsies and do death investigation as a doctor. During that time, she actually ended up doing it 2 years because she decided also to study neuropathology, which is brains and spinal cords. During that two-year time that she was doing autopsies, Judy kept a journal every day. And eventually, she handed it off to me and said, okay, let's write a book. I'm a writer, and between the two of us, we turned her journal into a work of narrative nonfiction, which is called Working Stiff. Without further ado, here's Dr. Judy Melnick.
Hi. I wanted to also additionally add that I currently live in San Francisco and work for the Alameda County Sheriff Coroner's Office. So I'm a contract pathologist in Alameda County doing autopsies. In fact, I did an autopsy today. And I'm a UCSF Associate Clinical Professor. So I'm going to start off just by giving you an overview of coroners and medical examiners. Coroners and medical examiners get called when someone dies at home or if the death is sudden or unexpected. And both type of offices, whether it's a coroner or a medical examiner's office, have investigators who collect the dead body and talk to the family. And then they also have doctors like me who then perform the autopsies. And the doctors may or may not get called out to the scene depending on the individual office and the individual case. So a lot of people don't know the difference between coroners and medical examiners, and even physicians sometimes, when I ask them, don't know the difference and get confused. Which one are you? Coroners are ordinary citizens. They have no specified training. In California, they take a 2-week course that they call Coroner's College. I put that in air quotes, down in Ventura County in order to be able to sign death certificates that say that someone died from an accident or a suicide or a homicide. And they're often administrators or law enforcement officers. They are often elected or appointed. And they may not have very much medical training or none at all, except for on-the-job training to be a coroner. Medical examiners are physicians. So in most cases, they are usually board certified in forensic pathology, and that's the specialty that I'm in. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what board certification means. They are often either part of the public health department or work in affiliation with them because our job is intricately involved in public health. And they're usually appointed as opposed to elected because you need to have that training and you're not going to just run for elected office if you don't have that training. So In the United States, it's a hodgepodge of systems. You could see that some states have district medical examiners like Florida does. In California, we have a mixture of medical examiner and coroner system depending on the county. The yellow ones have coroners in each county on this particular map. So really, the decision of whether you have a coroner or medical examiner, it's defined to some degree by state law and then individually county by county. So it depends on what county you're in, whether you're going to be served by a medical examiner or coroner. So here in the city and county of San Francisco, we are served by the office of the chief medical examiner. It's an office that's run by a physician, and it's part of the Department of Administrative Services of the city and county. In Alameda County, where I work for a sheriff. So I'm part of the sheriff's department, which is a law enforcement agency. So what does it mean to be a board-certified forensic pathologist? That means you're certified by an organization called the American Board of Pathology. So the minimum training required are 4 years of medical school. This is in the United States. 3 to 4 years of residency. I did four. Four is for both anatomic pathology, having to do with organs, and clinical pathology, having to do with laboratory medicine. And then you, at the minimum, you need 1 year of fellowship. I did two in New York City, and that's the subject of working stiff. You also have to pass an examination, an anatomic pathology exam, before you're even eligible to sit for the second exam, a forensic pathology exam. Both examinations have about a 33% failure rate. So they're tough, and you study for about a year for each one. There are only 500 or so board-certified forensic pathologists currently practicing in the United States. So I know if you watch television, you think if there's one on every corner. That's not actually the case. And think about what 500 people are. I mean, that was my entire high school was 500 people. We kind of know everybody. We not know them personally, but we know of them, or we know people who used to work there. So our conferences tend to be people that we get to know over a period of time pretty well. So in every state, there are laws that define what cases go to the medical examiner or coroner. And I'm quoting here from the California Health and Safety Code 10250 and the Government Code 27491. But other states have very similar laws. And typically, they say that any death that's violent, sudden, or unusual has to be reported to the medical examiner or coroner. If the death was unattended by a physician in the last 20 days before death, that means that the person wasn't expected to die and they weren't being seen by a doctor, that should be reported. And any death related to accident or injury. And notice how vague it is, either old or recent. There is no time interval there. So even if the accident was 20 years ago and you think the death is related to that, it needs to be reported to the coroner or medical examiner. Any death that's a homicide, a suicide, or an accident, and any death related in any way to a criminal act. So these are the investigators from the San Francisco office. They sit at the desks, and they have computers and terminals and phones, and they're the ones who answer the phone calls when the hospital or the EMS or the dispatch from 911 calls and lets us know, hey, there's a dead body. You need to report to the scene. And they're the ones who report to the scene and meet with the family members and get information about the circumstances that preceded the death. Is there any medical history? What are the medical records? If the death is at the hospital, did they have any kind of procedures or therapy? That information they collect and they put in a report. Now, the reporting requirements, the people who are calling it in, we have to be notified for those types of death that are specified in the government code, but the only requirement is for the medical examiner to investigate. And sometimes that investigation is that phone call. So, for example, if someone's in hospice care and they're expected to die of cancer, but their doctor hasn't seen them in 30 days as opposed to the 20 days that's specified by the law, that still needs to be reported to the office, but no office is going to bring that case in. So they have to call it in, and we have a very wide basket that we want to have cases reported, but of that big basket in the law, a subset of those are going to be brought into the office, and a subset of those are going to be autopsied. Not every case that is brought to the medical examiner or coroner's office is going to get an autopsy. Sometimes all we do is we review the medical records, we review the circumstances, and we will do an external examination, look at the outside of the body, make sure that there aren't any surprises, any injuries that weren't reported or unexpected, and then we will sign the death certificate, based on the medical records and the history. And in cases where families object to an autopsy, that's another situation where we will bring the case in. If there's nothing untoward, if there's no suspicion of foul play, we may certify the death based on the medical records and the circumstances. The other thing you need to know is that the medical examiner or coroner has a right to the medical record and can have it subpoenaed, but we shouldn't have to subpoena it. We're actually HIPAA exempt. So HIPAA is the Health Insurance Privacy, Portability, and Accountability Act. And ultimately, the reason why we can get these records, even though the families might object, is that we have a right to that because the state or the public interest generally will trump the privacy rights after death. And the permission of next of kin is not required for an autopsy in this country. And the reason for that is that sometimes the next of kin is responsible for the death and might want to cover it up. So we can trump that. And in cases where the state has a religious exemption law, like New York or now Minnesota, there are channels by which the medical examiner can approach a judge or bypass even the family's objection if they suspect that there's foul play involved and there's a public interest, like a killer out there that we have to catch, or a potentially transmissible infectious disease that we have to protect the public from. Also, if a death occurs in a hospital and they want an autopsy at the hospital, the physician in the hospital has to certify that it's a natural cause, it's due to disease, before allowing a hospital autopsy. If the doctors at the hospital aren't really sure why they died, that has to be reported too. So I'm going to give you the definition of cause of death, and in working stiff, Dr. Hirsch, the chief medical examiner, would actually stop us in the hallway and say, "What's the cause of death?" And we had to have this memorized. And I get asked this all the time when I'm on the stand and testifying, so I'm going to go line by line, because a lot of doctors don't even know this. The cause of death is the etiologically specific. I'm going to go line by line, and I'm going to explain each one. It's either a disease or an injury. So etiologically specific means it's not due to something else. So the example I like to give is that of a myocardial infarct, or our medical terminology for heart attack. Everybody knows you can die from a heart attack, right? Wrong. You can have a heart attack because you have too much cholesterol in your blood vessels, okay, and you have a clot in one of those vessels. That's called atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, in which case the manner is natural. You can also have a heart attack, a myocardial infarct, because you snorted too much cocaine that morning. Okay, that's going to be an accident because of the cocaine. And you can have a heart attack, a myocardial infarct, because someone shot you in the leg and you started to bleed out, and then your heart couldn't handle the blood loss and you had a heart attack. So the heart attack, the myocardial infarct, is the mechanism of death. The cause is either the atherosclerosis, the cocaine, or the gunshot wound. That's the underlying cause. That's the etiologically specific disease or injury. But it's the thing that starts the lethal sequence of events. So in the scenario of someone who jumps from a diving board and breaks their neck at the age of 20 and becomes a quadriplegic and then survives for 20 years with pneumonia and bed sores and all the complications that can come from being a quadriplegic, the injury to the neck is what started the lethal sequence of events. And so even when they die at the age of 40, 20 years after the injury, the cause of death is still due to complications from quadriplegia due to blunt trauma of neck and an accident if it's an accident. Nobody pushed him. So that's what started the lethal sequence of events. If that same quadriplegic is wheeled into the bank to take out money and then a bank robber comes in and shoots up the place and shoots him, that is a sufficient intervening cause. So the cause of death is the etiologically specific disease or injury which starts the lethal sequence of events without sufficient intervening causes. And so when you hear about cause of death in the paper, ask yourself, if they say the cause of death is a heart attack, you should wonder about that. And maybe what's the underlying cause is the question. And then you might also see in the papers when you read about cases or in deaths that affect your own life, what's called the manner of death. And the manner of death is a classification of the cause. Typically in the press, they conflate cause with manner. They'll say the cause of death was an accident. And that's not correct. It's the manner of death that's an accident. So manners of death, the classifications are natural when it's due to disease or aging, accident when it's due to an unforeseeable act or a hostile environment. And the example of a hostile environment would be someone who has a seizure disorder, for instance, and goes swimming and has a seizure and drowns. So being in that hostile environment of the water is making them drown, and therefore we defer to accident, not to their seizure disorder, which would be natural. And then a homicide would be, by definition, death at the hand of another. So when someone hits them or hurts them, they may not intend to kill them. We're not distinguishing between manslaughter or murder. Homicide just means death at the hand of another. And this is, again, another thing that the press tends to get wrong, where they'll say, well, the medical examiner called it a homicide. In the case of, for instance, Eric Garner, who was put in a chokehold and died. Well, by definition, it's death at the hand of another person. So they are calling it a homicide. They're not saying whether it's justifiable or not justifiable. They're not defining it as murder versus manslaughter. Those decisions are those for the DA who indicts and eventually for a judge or jury. But the decision of homicide is just a classification of the cause. And then we also have the option of suicide, which we define as a death from a self-destructive act. Typically, I want to show that there's a preponderance of the evidence, that the person intended to harm themselves. I also have the option of pending, where I'm waiting for my laboratory results. Once again, the press tends to get that one wrong. They usually say, well, the autopsy was inconclusive. And that's not correct. If the autopsy report is pending, meaning that we're waiting for the additional lab results, that doesn't mean we haven't made a conclusion. We don't have the information yet. So pending is not the same thing as the last one, which is undetermined. And undetermined is when we can't figure out which one it is, either because we don't have enough information or because the death doesn't easily classify into one category or another. So this is the morgue in San Francisco currently, and you can see the porcelain tables. They're actually embalming tables. I have to be careful not to drop my instruments on those so they don't chip. And you can see that they've got this old cantilever system, just like the old dentist office chairs. Those don't really work anymore. They're building San Francisco a new facility, so I believe it's going to be on a bond measure. I don't know if it's been approved yet, but I'm just letting you know that they're going to build San Francisco something like this, which is a state-of-the-art facility. If anybody recognizes the woman in the bottom corner of the slide, that's Dr. G, medical examiner in Florida. She just retired. She had her own TV show on Discovery Channel for a while. But a modern facility is state-of-the-art, has stainless steel tables and surgical lighting and is brightly lit. And I'm going to talk about how that's different from how forensics is portrayed on TV. So what is an autopsy? What do we do? And in Working Stiff, when we wrote the book, TJ actually interviewed me and said, okay, well, what do you do every day? You know, I would talk to him and he interviewed me about, well, what do you do when you get in and what do you put on and what do you look like? So what I do first when I look at the body is I start off on the outside of the body and I do an external examination. And typically I go from head to toe, noting things like the hair color and the eye color and whether the person's wearing makeup or whether their teeth are chips and all kinds of little details, scars, tattoos, any kind of marks that I might see, and work my way head to toe externally. And then I do the same thing but internally, take out the organs one by one. Each organ gets weighed and measured in some cases, and specimens are taken from the organs for testing, either for toxicology to look at to see if there are drugs in the system, or to histology, which is we look at the organs under the microscope. And each organ is documented for disease or looked at for disease or injury. And the documentation consists of my diagrams, my photographs, and the autopsy report. And these are the technicians in the toxicology lab. They receive the specimens, and they're the ones who run the tests. One of the questions I get asked a lot is, why does it take so long? Well, just like I said, there's only 500 board-certified forensic pathologists in the United States. There aren't a lot of forensic toxicologists either. So if you have nieces or nephews or children who are interested in a career where you'll always have a job, I highly recommend forensics and especially toxicology, because we really don't have enough technicians, and the offices are, in many cases, understaffed and underfunded, and they have to prioritize cases of people who are alive over people who are dead. So if there's a motor vehicle accident and a person's driving under the influence and those people are alive and there's potential pending litigation, they'll prioritize that over the dead case. So the first job that we have to do is figure out who the person is who died. And the way we do this in most cases is actually the least reliable way, which is the visual identification. There's a dead body, and then the family says, that's my Uncle Phil, and we ask what's his legal name, and they tell us, and we prioritize based on what they say. We'll take their word for it and write their name on the forms that eventually become the death certificate. But we always double check. So we will always take DNA and fingerprints on all of the cadavers that come to our office to compare them. And then I can continue, but so what's going on?
We're having some technical difficulties with the computer.
Yeah.
And somebody's in there working on it right now.
Okay.
And then
I can keep it going.
We'll
so I'm
going
to have to do it from memory then. Wow. Okay, here we go. Okay, so besides who are you, but the visual is not the most reliable, and people can lie. People can make mistakes also. So that's why we take things like x-rays and DNA, and we have fingerprints on all of our cases in case there's any question. And in the homicide cases, we most definitely do the scientific modalities in order to confirm who they are. The next thing we do, besides figuring out who we are, who the person is we have to figure out why they died. And in terms of figuring out why they died, again, if you watch television, you'd think that the majority of what I deal with are homicides, that it's usually something suspicious or something, there's foul play involved. If you watch TV, every case is a homicide or a suspicious death. The reality is that I will do about 200 cases in a given year, and only about 10% of those are homicides. Only 20 will be homicides. The remainder will be people who die at their home and there's no one there, and nobody witnessed it, and they may or may not have any medical history. So typically they're natural deaths or overdoses. A lot of them are accidents, slips and falls. And then we also have suicide, self-inflicted death. That's about another 10, 20%. And then we also have the accidents. So motor vehicle collisions, falls from heights, industrial accidents, those have to be investigated as well because they're agencies that need to know, is there a public health hazard that we need to address? So those are the majority of cases. I always get asked, how do you sort out those cases? How can you figure out what the cause of death is? And the majority of cases are easy. You either find a lot of trauma in a motor vehicle accident or a gunshot wound to the head, or you find an overwhelming natural disease. It's the 10% of cases that take up the 90% of our time. Those are the difficult ones. And in those cases, usually the reason they're difficult is because the case has a great story, but the body doesn't match up to the story. Or it has no story at all, and there's way too much trauma on the body for no story at all. So there's a disconnect, either a great story and not enough injury on the body, or too much injury on the body and a story that doesn't explain it. And in those circumstances, that's a signal to me that I have to investigate further, and I need to ask more questions. And as Dr. Hirsch says, and we quote him in Working Stiff, you solve more cases with a telephone than you do with a microscope. So it means getting on the phone and talking to the family, talking to the police, getting the medical records and reviewing those, and that's how we sort those out. So at this particular point, since the slide is down, what I'll do is I'll take pause. So I'll just take some questions at this point, and then we can resume once we've got the AV back up. Is that okay? So we'll get the microphone into the audience.
Okay.
What special difficulties are created by decomposed bodies?
I'm glad you asked that. I actually had a decomposed body this morning. So when a person and I showered. When a person starts to decompose, and remember, decomposition happens immediately after death because what happens is it starts slowly and it may not be noticeable immediately, and we could slow it down with refrigeration, but the body's own enzymes start to digest the cells themselves. That's called autolysis. And then we also have bacteria in our gut and in our oral cavity, and they decide, oh, I have free rein now. So they enter our bloodstream and they start the process called putrefaction. So when you have a markedly decomposed body, you can still do an autopsy. And in many cases, you can definitely figure out if the case is a homicide, especially if there's penetrating trauma. Bullets are going to still be in there. Stab wounds are still going to damage the internal organs, and there'll be hemorrhage inside. You could still see that in a decomposed body. And in blunt trauma, you can have fractures, especially of the skull or of the neck. Or in strangulations, you'll see fractures of the hyoid bone, which is a delicate bone in the neck. So just because the body's putrefied doesn't mean you can't figure out the cause of death. In many cases, if it's traumatic, it's easier. But it becomes more difficult when it's natural disease or when it's subtle findings that can be obscured by the decomposition. And in those cases, we have to be more cautious in terms of our determination. And that's where a lot of the undetermined sometimes come in. is where we're not certain because of the condition of the body.
And it's common for Judy to do decomp cases, and it's one of the things that sets her apart from other doctors. And I was really dreading doing the chapter which we titled Stinks and Bones. It's an entire chapter devoted to decomps, and I thought, this is going to be horrendous. What am I doing? And it was one of my favorite things in the book. It turns out to be a really fascinating subject.
First of all, I want to say how much I admire your ability to remain cool with your whole computer AV system, like, going on the blink.
She investigates murders.
Yeah. I'm also very curious what brought you into this field.
Well, what happened was I start off writing to some degree about my father being a doctor, and he was a psychiatrist. And when I was 13 years old, he committed suicide. He had always encouraged me to go into medicine, and I loved learning from him. When I was a kid, it would not be unusual for me to sit down at dinner with him, and he would explain the nervous system to me and draw out nerves and axons and the synapses and how chemicals work on. I mean, I asked him all sorts of questions, and he always had the answers. So I was definitely drawn to medicine because of his tutoring, but he was never around after the age of 13 when I was really developing academically. So I knew I wanted to be a doctor, and I was pretty certain I did not want to be a psychiatrist. When I went through medical school, you go through rotations to try to figure out what specialty you want to go through. And I had done a post-sophomore fellowship in pathology. I spent a year doing pathology, going through different departments in pathology. And I want to give a shout-out to Anna, who is actually one of my senior residents.
Dr. Anna Salinger.
Dr. Anna Salinger is over here. And she's actually now a pediatrician. I taught you how to do your first autopsy, right? So I had done autopsy the month before she did, and I hadn't even finished medical school yet. And I'm the one who taught her how to do an autopsy. And I realized really quickly, I was like, you should not be a pathologist. You need to be a pediatrician. So, because she loved the babies.
Yeah, she kept sneaking into the nursery to sniff the babies.
That's
is
right.
What Judy told me.
That was a hint. But at the time, you know, I loved medicine, and I didn't know much about the different specialties. And while I was doing pathology, I actually worked with the liver transplant team doing research with them and fell in love with surgery. And I was going to be a surgeon. I loved the technical aspects of surgery. I loved the challenges. I loved staying up at night and fixing things. And then I collapsed while I was doing my surgery residency because it was just too grueling. It was too physically exhausting. And TJ watched me go through this and saw the deterioration.
Yeah, Judy was working 130 hours a week.
And it was uncomfortable.
I didn't know there were 130 hours in a week. I really didn't. And she turned into a zombie. And we never would have stayed together. We never would have been married if she'd continued on that path.
So when I quit surgery, he also, the first time I collapsed on the job, it was just from exhaustion. And he said, no, go back. You should do this. But the second time it happened, I actually had the flu and I had a fever. And he said, this is not the right field for you. You've tried it. It hasn't worked out. And because I had done the pathology year in medical school, I had an out. So after leaving surgery, I went back to pathology, and I was the happiest pathologist ever. And I recruited people to pathology, and I loved doing autopsies. But I didn't have the passion for it that I had for surgery until I did my rotation at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. I'm going to read to you. The opening chapter of the book is about my rotation at the Medical Examiner's Office when I discovered that I wanted to be a forensic pathologist.
So should we continue?
Oh, yeah. So let me continue since we're back on. Great. So this is where I left off. So.
Oh, and then when Judy finishes here, we have a six-minute reading of the beginning of the book, and then we'll take questions and answers, and we'll be happy to sell and sign books.
Yeah, so there's a signing at the end, too. So this is exactly what I was saying. The Got that? Oh, it's you. It's his fault. It's his fault. He's by the speaker. Okay, so how does a medical examiner decide on the cause of death? The majority of cases, like I said, are easy, and the ones are hard when there's a disconnect and I need to do more investigation. So a good medical examiner really waits to review all the data that's available before coming to a final determination. It means digging. You can't just take the easy answer. I also try to meet with different groups associated with a case, and when I say that, I mean that would be the family members or the police or the doctor who took care of the patient. And I don't have to meet with them in person. Sometimes I get the medical records or I talk to them on the phone. I don't have to have them come down to my office. And I try to keep an open mind and remain objective before deciding on the cause of death. One of the things Dr. Hirsch taught us is that the death certificate is written in paper, on paper. It's not written in stone. So even if you make a mistake, we can change it. If additional information comes up, if there's a discovery that something happened, it can be changed. And all you have to do is have a reasonable medical probability that you made a mistake or that the circumstances now indicate that there's another cause. So that death certificate, that piece of paper that certifies that a person has died, is a really important document. There are many people who live in the United States and do not have birth certificates. Either they never got it, or they were born in another country, or they just lost it, and they function just fine, and they do well until they die. Because when they die, their body cannot be buried, and their family cannot close their bank accounts or inherit any of their money without that death certificate. So that death certificate is actually a lot more important than a birth certificate. It's used by family to get insurance money and inherit property, but it's also used by historians who try to figure out what killed people at different periods of time. And it's used by scientists who are looking at mortality data to figure out whether their therapies are working or whether there are trends happening as a result of environmental impacts. It's also used by statisticians, and it's being used by politicians who decide how much money to donate to put into the law enforcement versus public health systems in their county. So the autopsy report itself is another this is the document that I generate. I sign the death certificate, and I write the autopsy report. And it has a structure that's similar to the structure of the autopsy itself. There's an identification section, which says how we identified the body, usually by a tag on the toe. And then we have the external examination where I describe the outside of the body. And then there's separate sections for any therapy that was done, any injury on the body. Then we have the internal examination where every organ system is described. And at the end, there's the diagnosis, the cause of death, and the manner of death. So a big aspect of what I do is I'm also called to testify in court, because many of the cases that come to the medical examiner, because they're sudden, because they're unexpected, because they're violent, they're often due to someone's fault, whether it's an accident or a homicide. And I'll get called both in criminal cases and in civil cases in litigation for wrongful death. And I want to explain the difference between a fact witness and an expert witness. I actually recently got into an argument with an attorney about this who didn't understand the difference. So a fact witness can only testify to just the fact, what they saw and what they heard. They cannot rely on hearsay. They can't talk about what other people said to them, and they cannot give an opinion. So to give you an example, if I reached over and – I hate to do this to you, honey.
She's always shooting me in this example.
And I shot my husband. I took out a gun, and I shot my husband right now, and I ran out the door. All of you guys would be fact witnesses. You saw me pull out the gun. You saw me shoot my husband. But the people out there – who didn't see or hear anything, they cannot be called to testify based on you guys telling them what happened, okay? That would be hearsay. They are not considered witnesses, okay? And all of you, you cannot say when you testify that, oh, my goodness, Dr. Melnick went crazy. I saw that look in her eye, because you are not psychiatrists, and you are not qualified to give an opinion on my mental state. You didn't interview me. You don't know my psychiatric history. So in order to give an opinion, you have to be an expert witness. And an expert witness means that the court qualifies you. So when I start to testify, the first thing I do is I actually recite my curriculum vitae. I go through my resume. I say where I went to school and what I learned and my degrees and my honors and all that. And then the attorney will ask the judge to qualify me as an expert in a particular field. So I can't just be qualified as an expert in everything. I have to be qualified as an expert in forensic pathology or wound interpretation. And so that way, if I get asked questions about, let's say, ballistics that I don't know about, I could say that's not my expertise. And in that capacity, I can give opinions because I'm giving an opinion about the medical diagnoses, and I can also rely on hearsay. Hearsay being what the family told me over the phone or what I read in the medical records. That's all hearsay. There are even cases I've had where the police interviewed dozens of witnesses and many of them disappeared and they weren't available anymore. But in the civil litigation case, I was asked, what did you rely on? Well, I relied on the police reports. So I actually read the police reports into the record, which normally that's not allowed, but I'm an expert and I can rely on hearsay. And if they ask me the question, I can tell them what I relied on. So currently in the United States, one of the challenges that we're experiencing in forensic pathology is that we do not have enough of us. And so there are problems with recruiting. 28% of fellowship positions are not filled. Funding is difficult. It's usually on a county level, and it tends to be crisis responsive. And then we also have restrictions on research. We can't just be doing experiments on dead bodies. There needs to be consent. There needs to be knowledge, and people have to donate their bodies to science, specifically for forensics, which they don't often. So there's a lack of funding. And without qualified forensic scientists, crimes are not going to even be recognized. We get to bury our mistakes. That's one of the advantages, I guess, of the job. But innocent people can go to jails and criminals can go free, and that's not a good system. So we really need to recruit more people in here. And also what's important is the families don't have closure. They're always going to be wondering what if. So I get asked a lot about whether my job is like CSI, and in some ways it is. It's fun, it's icky, it's scientific, and it's dramatic. I'm dealing with people during a very difficult time of their life when they're going through a lot of drama. But I actually wrote a Google, if you Google 7 CSI fails, I wrote a blog post about the things that, for it's not just CSI, it's NCIS, it's Forensic Files, it's every single one of them. The things
and,
that
and
they
we
get
can't
wrong.
Watch any of these shows. She starts shouting and throwing things at the television right away.
Yeah. Or I ruin them for you. Like I walk in and I go, oh, that's strychnine poisoning. It goes, what? No, it's not. And then at the end, of course, they say it is, and he gets mad at me. So the things that CSI consistently gets wrong is they're constantly in the dark. You'll see them in the top photo. Of course, they're sitting in the dark. Look, they're in a laboratory. They're looking at the specimens, and yet he's shining a flashlight at it, okay? Our laboratory, as you saw in the previous slide, is very well lit. If you can't see the evidence, you cannot collect the evidence. So that's really important. They are constantly walking around in really high heels. I would like to demonstrate my heel size today. So there we go. One of the reasons we wear sensible shoes is not only because they're comfortable and they don't damage your feet in the long run, but also you can get called out to a crime scene at 2 o'clock in the morning in the marina where it's uneven, or on a slope where there's a park and you're going to be walking through mud, so you're not going to ruin your shoes that way. Plus, nobody can afford Louboutins on a government salary. And then they always have the forensic scientists up in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning doing autopsies. One of the reasons I was drawn to this field is that it's not like surgery. They'll still be dead tomorrow. The hours are generally 9 to 5, and if you're there at late hours, there needs to be a reason, like a pending investigation that's happening right now, like you get called to a scene. Generally, overtime is monitored because it's a county job. So the other thing to consider is that they're constantly dating each other and sleeping with police and DAs. I mean, listen, intramural romances are a problem in any job. You don't want to get involved romantically with people that you work with in any profession, but all the more so if you're going to be on the stand testifying on these cases, because there are going to be questions asked about your bias. So this is a field where really it's not a good idea to get involved romantically at work. They get the lab results right away on television within like seconds while the body's still on the table. This creates an unrealistic expectation, and family members will call me and say, why is it taking so long? Because they have an expectation that we should get the lab results immediately because that's what they see on TV. The other thing you typically see is on CSI, they're never wearing face masks, face shields, or even gloves. I mean, look at this. He's got his hands on the autopsy table and doesn't even have gloves there, versus on the right-hand side, you could see that's how we're actually dressed, with face shield, with a mask. We have to protect ourselves. There are potentially blood-borne pathogens, and we have to make sure that we're healthy. And then finally, the holograms. Kathy Reichs is lovely. She's a forensic anthropologist and is the force behind Bones, and I once heard her speak and say, everything on Bones actually exists. And yes, they do exist on some sort of laboratory in Switzerland, but it doesn't exist in the routine coroner or medical examiner's office that's typically underfunded. I'm happy when my x-ray machine is working. I'm happy when I've got all my gear and there are enough towels, for instance. So yes, it's nice that we have wonderful forensic science available theoretically and that we have research, but the routine office is pretty much working with equipment that you'd recognize from your kitchen as opposed to from any surgical suite. So now we're going to read from Working Stiff, and I'm going to point to you to this photo at a little bit later. The one on the bottom right is that of our son Daniel, and we mentioned this in the opening chapter, so this is proof that it actually happened, that we didn't just make this stuff up. So here we go. You got your mic? Okay.
So this is from the very opening of the book. chapter one, the title of chapter one is "This Can Only End Badly." Remember, this can only end badly.
That's what my husband says anytime I start a story. He's right. So, this carpenter is sitting on a sidewalk in Midtown Manhattan with his buddies, half a dozen subcontractors in hard hats, sipping their coffees before the morning shift gets started. The remains of a hurricane blew over the city the day before, halting construction. But now it's back to business on the office tower they've been building for 8 months.
As the sun comes up and the traffic din grows, a new noise punctures the hum of taxis and buses, a metallic creak not immediately menacing. The creak turns into a groan, and somebody yells. The workers can't hear too well over the diesel noise and gusting wind, but they can tell the voice is directed at them. The groan sharpens to a screech. The men look up, then jump to their feet and sprint off, their coffee flying everywhere. The carpenter chooses the wrong direction. With an earth-shaking crash, the derrick of a 383-foot-tall construction crane slams down on James Frierson's head.
I arrived at this gruesome scene 2 hours later with a team of MLIs, medical legal investigators from the New York City Office of Chief Medical Examiner. The crane had fallen directly across a busy intersection at rush hour, and the police had shut it down, snarling traffic in all directions. The MLI driving the morgue van cursed like a sailor as he inched us the last few blocks to the cordon line. Medical legal investigators are the medical examiner's first responders, going to the site of an untimely death, examining and documenting everything there, and transporting the body back to the city morgue for an autopsy. I was starting a month-long program designed to introduce young doctors to the world of forensic death investigation and had never worked outside a hospital. "Doc," the MLI behind the wheel said to me at one hopelessly gridlocked corner, "I hope you don't turn out to be a black cloud. Yesterday all we had to do was scoop up one little old lady from Beth Israel ER. Today we get this clusterfuck." "Watch your step," a police officer warned when I got out of the van. The steel boom had punched a foot-deep hole in the sidewalk when it came down on Frierson. A hard hat was still there, lying on its side in a pool of blood and brains, coffee and donuts. I had spent the previous 4 years training as a hospital pathologist in a fluorescent-lit world of sterile labs and blue scrubs. Now I found myself at a windy crime scene in the middle of Manhattan rush hour. Gore on the sidewalk, blue lights and yellow tape, a crowd of gawkers, grim cops, and coworkers who kept using the word clusterfuck. I was hooked.
How did it happen?
My husband TJ wanted to know when I got home. The crane crushed his head. He winced.
I mean, how come it toppled over? We were at the small playground downstairs from the apartment, watching our toddler son Danny arrange all the battered plastic trucks and rusty tricycles in a line, making a train.
The crane was strapped down overnight because of the hurricane warning yesterday. The operator either forgot or never knew, and I guess he didn't check it. He started the engine, pushed the throttle, and nothing happened. So he gunned it, and the straps broke.
Oh, man,
TJ said, rubbing his forehead.
Now it's a catapult.
Exactly. The crane went up, hung there for a second, and crumpled over itself backwards.
Jesus. What about the driver?
What do you mean?
Was the crane driver hurt?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, what about the other workers?
I don't know, I repeated. None of them were dead. TJ was looking off into the trees.
Where did this happen?
I told you, on 6th Avenue.
And what?
I don't remember. What does it matter? You're going to avoid that corner because a crane could drop on your head?
Well?
It doesn't happen that often, believe me. Our raised voices had drawn the attention of the other parents on the bench.
Civilians.
TJ warned, under his breath, reminding me that no one on a playground full of preschoolers wanted to hear our discussion of a grisly workplace accident.
Did he have a wife, kids?
He asked quietly. He had a wife. I don't know about kids. My husband looked at me askance. Look, I don't deal with these things. The investigators take care of all that. I only have to worry about the body.
Okay. So tell me about the body.
As part of my medical school training, I had done autopsies before, but they were all clinical, patients who had died in the hospital. I'd never seen a corpse like this one. We had to do a full autopsy because it's a workplace accident. It was amazing. He was a big guy, muscular, no heart disease, vessels clean, not a scratch on his limbs or torso, but his head looked like an egg you'd smash on the counter. We even call it an eggshell skull fracture. Isn't that cool?
No.
TJ replied, suddenly ashen.
No, it isn't.
I'm not a ghoulish person. I'm a guileless, sunny optimist. In fact, when I first started training in death investigation, TJ worried my new job would change the way I looked at the world. He feared that after a few months of hearing about the myriad ways New Yorkers die, the two of us would start looking up nervously for window air conditioners to fall on our heads. Maybe we'd steer Danny's stroller around sidewalk grates instead of rolling over them. We would, he was sure, never again set foot in murderous Central Park.
You're going to turn me into one of those crazy people who leaves the house wearing a surgical mask and gloves,
he declared during a West Nile virus scare. Instead, my experience had the opposite effect. It freed me, and eventually my husband as well, from our 6 o'clock news phobias. Once I became an eyewitness to death, I found that nearly every unexpected fatality I investigated was either the result of something dangerously mundane or of something predictably hazardous.
So don't jaywalk. Wear your seatbelt when you drive. Better yet, stay out of your car and get some exercise. Watch your weight. If you're a smoker, stop right now. If you aren't, don't start. Guns put holes in people. Drugs are bad. You know that yellow line on the subway platform? It's there for a reason. Staying alive, as it turns out, is mostly common sense.
Mostly. As I would also learn at the New York City office of Chief Medical Examiner, unexpected anatomical defects do occasionally cause otherwise healthy people to drop dead. One in a million fatal diseases crop up, and New York has 8 million people. There are open manholes, stray bullets, there are crane accidents. I don't understand how you can do it, friends, even fellow physicians tell me, but all doctors learn to objectify their patients to a certain extent. You have to suppress your emotional responses or you wouldn't be able to do your job. In some ways, it's easier for me because a dead body really is an object, no longer a person at all. More important, that dead body is not my only patient. The survivors are the ones who really matter. I work for them too.
Okay, so now we can take questions again if you'd like.
Yeah, we have 15 more minutes for questions. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Enjoyed your talk. So I am a transplant surgeon, and I'd love to hear how you work through a request when there's a case that's eligible for the coroner or medical examiner, yet potentially they could be an organ donor.
Typically, it depends on the circumstances surrounding the death. So in the majority of cases, even a homicide wouldn't necessarily rule out a suspected homicide wouldn't necessarily rule out a person from being an organ donor if they've family's been approached and it's already been the family wants to do it. A lot of times we'll get asked even before the family gets asked, so it's kind of coordinated to try to figure out whether we really want to approve it, if it's not going to get approved by the family anyway, or if they get timed out because there's timing issues as well, especially for tissue harvesting. Ultimately, there is a law in California and in other states as well that can trump to some degree the coroner medical examiner, but we are allowed to go to the harvest and actually witness the organs being taken. Typically,
that's what it's called, for those of you who are not doctors. It completely shocked me the first time Judy started using this word. It's called the harvest when they go in and take the body.
Now they call it procurement. I'm still using
harvest is a bad word now.
Yeah, no, I know. You use procurement now. I'm dating myself. I worked with the liver transplant team in UCLA for about 10 years, and I was going to be a transplant surgeon, actually, so I know quite a bit about transplantation. The issues in the case are there have been rare cases where bodies of people who have died under suspicious circumstances have had their organs taken, and then whatever the consequences of the findings were at the autopsy were mitigated or limited by the fact that the organs had been taken for either transplant or research. And litigation could not proceed in a few rare criminal cases. And these have been published in the medical literature. So that's what we're trying to avoid. We want to make sure that whatever decision we make is not going to limit our ability to properly diagnose a suspicious death and also an infectious death. Because in an infectious death, you don't want those organs anyway because you're going to immunosuppress those patients. And that could be a potential hazard as well. There have also been rare cases of transplants going in people where there was an undiagnosed infectious disease, and it was only picked up because of autopsy. So we are listening for things that signal an infectious modality or that could be a potential public health hazard that will stop us from giving a donation. And we're listening for things in the history or the medical records that signal that if I give that organ away, I may not be able to diagnose the cause of death. And that's what usually stops us. But they're becoming rarer and rarer that medical examiners and coroners are going to stop donation. A lot of it depends on open communication between your local agency and the medical examiner's office. So if you're working in San Francisco, there's really good dialogue with the San Francisco ME's office. So it's rarely going to be a problem.
Autopsy, by the way, means see for yourself. It comes from the Greek for see for yourself. That's what forensic pathologists like Judy do, is they open the body up and they take a look at absolutely everything. They answer all the questions.
Hi, Judy. I'm just wondering if any of the undetermineds live on with you. It's the lack of satisfaction that you've got from not being able to tell the true cause of death.
They are frustrating because, well, first of all, there's undetermined cause and there's undetermined manner. Sometimes I can figure out the cause, blunt trauma of head, because a person has a subdural, but I don't know when they got injured. They're just found dead in bed in their house, and they've got this bleed in their brain that came from trauma, but I don't have a history. They may have fallen in the bathroom. They may have fallen in their kitchen. They may have gone to a bar and gotten punched, and I just don't know because I don't have any history. And I asked the police or I asked the family, and nobody knows there's no documentation of any injury. So those are – the cause is known, but the manner is undetermined. And I can sleep with those more easily than the ones where I can't even figure out the cause. Those can be frustrating, especially when you're dealing with a young individual who doesn't have any medical history and you do a full autopsy and toxicology and everything's negative. That really shows me the limitation of what an autopsy can do, because an autopsy can show you anatomy, but it cannot show you physiology. So, for instance, if you have a seizure disorders occur in what in an anatomical sense looks like a perfectly normal brain, but your first seizure, if it kills you, which does rarely happen, I will never be able to figure that out. And so there are rare cases of people dying from their first seizure or people dying of an arrhythmia, an irregular rhythm in their heart. And I can't see an arrhythmia death. If the heart anatomy is normal, I'm not going to necessarily be able to diagnose it. And they're going to be rare. The ones where the cause and the manner are undetermined are probably less than 1%. Of our practice. And they do bug you, but after a while you realize that's the limitation of the procedure. I can't figure it all out.
She's also a very busy lady. She moves on to other case. Other cases. It was always bothering me that I'd ask her, ooh, what happened to that homicide that you did 3 weeks ago? She says, I don't know. I guess the DA did. I don't know. I don't go lurking around the DA's office to ask them what happened with the homicides. I got more things to do.
Can you tell us about one of your more difficult cases and how you solved it eventually?
One of the cases that I find the most challenging, I should start with, are not the ones that you'd see on TV, the homicides. The ones that I think that are most challenging are the therapeutic complications. When a person dies in the hospital and the doctors can't figure out why they died, and then they bring them to me and they go, you figure it out? Like, I'm supposed to know more than they do. And so the stakes are higher and the pressure is on. One of the most complex and interesting cases I've had was one of a man who had died after plastic surgery. He stopped breathing while he was supposed to be monitored by a nurse, and then they resuscitated him. He survived for 3 days in the hospital but was essentially brain dead and then came to my autopsy table 3 days later. So trying to figure out, why did he stop breathing after the plastic surgery? Was there a complication from the surgery? Did he get too much medication? What was going on there? Was really complicated. And it was also complicated by the fact that the nursing notes were missing and the monitor was missing. So it ended up...
A monitor is a big piece of equipment.
Yeah, so if the nursing notes are missing, then I want to know, well, what's his heart rate? What's his blood pressure? What's his respiratory rate? What were the parameters? Was he dwindling or did it all happen at once? That will help me figure out why he stopped breathing or why his heart stopped beating. And the nurse had lost or misplaced these things. And then when I asked, well, where's the monitor? This is multiple $1,000 piece of equipment. And the fact that that was missing as well really put suspicion on this nurse. So we actually treated the case like a homicide. The homicide detectives got video footage from the garage, and they saw the nurse going to her car with a very big bag. And as we started and continued to investigate the case and put word out to the family and to the attorneys, because attorneys, of course, were getting being interested in the case. The monitor showed up 6 months later at the nurse's attorney's office, but it had been erased. So there was no data on it anymore. And in the end, after many months of investigating this case, I certified it as a homicide because of medical negligence. It became pretty apparent that she had not been monitoring the patient. She had not taken notes. Her notes were briefly viewed by the anesthesiologist at the hospital, who saw that they were incomplete and handed them back to her and said, fill this out, like get the information and complete this. And that's when they disappeared. She, on her own statement, said that she couldn't operate the AMBU bag, which is a bag that's used to give people oxygen, which is basic nursing training. So in the end, the DA ended up charging her with stealing the monitor and interfering with a police investigation, not with a murder. They charged her with the crime of interfering with the investigation. She pled no contest, and then 2 years later, it finally went before the nursing board, and her license was taken away. I had to testify in that hearing. So that's satisfying to me, because I know that this is a case that nobody else would have necessarily pursued it to that degree, and if I hadn't called it for what it was, I think she would still be practicing nursing, and I find that very concerning.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Hey, Judy and TJ, how was it to write the book together?
A lot of people ask us this because we're a married couple, and they say, I can't imagine working with my spouse. And we had a great time writing the book together. Honestly, we really did. Because we now have three children, we mostly wrote the book by emailing each other back and forth.
Yeah, that's right.
Whenever we're in the same room together, we're not able to actually work because the children are demanding our attention. Right.
But we should explain the process, though. So while I was doing my fellowship training in New York City, I actually kept a journal. I kept a diary. Every single day I wrote down what I did that day. And I wasn't really a journal keeper or a diary keeper as a kid. Intermittently I had my romances that I wrote as a teenager. But I didn't keep a diary regularly. I thought of keeping it specifically for forensics because I knew that there were a lot of TV shows that were out there and that misrepresented forensics, but there was nothing that really focused on the training process. So I knew that as I'm going through the training process, I want to remember what I'm going through. And if I could share that with other people, then they would also learn as well along with me. So the concept for the book came to me even before I started my fellowship. So I kept that journal every day. And then I started, as you know, in July of 2001, and I had basically 2 months of training before September 11th happened. So when September 11th happened, I realized that not only are my notes or my journal important for me emotionally, but this is history. So I got to keep writing.
Judy is one of the 30 doctors who identified the remains after the World Trade Center attack.
And it helped me process what I was going through. So I just kept going. And at the end of the 2 years, we actually had, I was pregnant and I had a daughter, Leia, who's born at the end of the book. She's now 12, to give you a perspective of time. So while I was on maternity leave, I took the journal, which was in chronological order, and I put it into cases because typically, I'll do an autopsy one day. The person may not even be identified at that time. They might be identified the next day. I'll speak to the family a week later. I'll get the tox report a month later, and I may not testify in court until maybe a year later or 2 years later. So I had to find those little pieces in the journal and put them together to structure them in the structure that we had. And even though September 11th happened 2 months into my fellowship, I wanted to put it towards the end of the book for a reason, because you can't really wrap your head around how forensic pathologists respond to a mass disaster until you understand what they do on a day-to-day basis, because that was happening simultaneously. I was still doing natural deaths and accidents and suicides while we were processing the remains from September 11th.
So Judy had this diary that she had rearranged into cases, and then she
handed it to me
and said, okay,
do something with this.
You're a writer, so write it. And essentially, I just started going through it, turning it into a work of narrative nonfiction, and emailing back and forth to her, and we'd make changes together, and it worked out brilliantly. We really enjoyed it.
So
we're working on a new book together now. We're working on fiction, a detective novel called First Cut, which is based very loosely on Judy's experience right here in San Francisco doing autopsies.
I just wanted to kind of make a comment, I think, rather than a question, but it might be a question. I'm kind of surprised and pleasantly surprised how brilliant you are and how compassionate you are, too, and trying to get to the bottom and get to the truth about how somebody died and the diligence you go about it. I'm only halfway through the book, but It's kind of a surprise that you're young, you have a family. I kind of had this stereotype thought about, you know, a pathologist must be an old, crotchety, gray-haired man who, you know, kind of Kevorkian type, bitter type of character. And so,
and those people do exist.
I'm sure they do, but it's kind of refreshing to see, you know, you're youthful and young and you have a family. And so is that, what's the field like? You know, we have this distortion of the TV, glamorous, high-heeled people, and then they... And now I'm meeting you, a real person who seems very authentic. What is the field like?
The field's evolving. I mean, I think that that grizzled older gentleman pathologist is that they still exist. I work with three older gentlemen at the Alameda County office. They're not grizzled. They're not nasty. They're the nicest people in the world. I love them dearly. And one thing that is consistently wrong is that most pathologists really love their jobs and find it incredibly satisfying because it really is about the survivors. Just like we read, that's why we do this. This is not about the dead bodies. We do want to tell the dead body stories, but really it's for the living that we do our job. So you have to have empathy in order to do this. If you don't have empathy, you're not going to be able to express yourself effectively when you're testifying to a jury. You're not going to be able to express yourself effectively to the family members and get information from them when you need it. So empathy is a really huge part of the job, and the people who lose it end up losing their capacity to investigate deaths thoroughly as well.
Another thing that keeps Judy young and vibrant, besides of course,
you,
the love of a good man, is that when she goes into work every day, there's something interesting there.
Oh, it's fascinating.
And other doctors our age are starting to get mid-career blues, where even if they're saving lives, they're still doing the same procedure every day. Judy never knows what she's going to see in the morgue, and it might be something she's never seen before.
Yeah, and every day it's a surprise. I mean, you never know what it's like the Forrest Gump thing. It's like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And that's how I feel every day when I walk into the morgue. It's always a surprise. It's always something new. It's always something I haven't seen in a while. It's fun. It's a really fun job.
Okay. Well, we thank Dr. Judy Melnick and T.J. Mitchell for their presentation this evening on Working Stiff, and now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.